We are very grateful to Stan Pugliese. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be able to call on him, particularly at this time. We're all doing our part in our different corners of the community to resist, make sense, go forward, hold on to our democracy. Stan Pugliese is going to give us a presentation entitled Primo Levi, Umberto Eco, and the Resurgence of Fascism. I'll tell you a little bit about Stan's background so that you understand, if you haven't heard him speak here before, the perspective from which he's coming and the context in which he'll be viewing some of our contemporary events. Stan is professor of modern European history at Hofstra University and the Queensborough Unico Distinguished Professor of Italian and Italian American Studies. He's written a number of biographies and read here from them, including Carlo Rosselli, Socialist Heretic and Anti-Fascist Exile, one about Ignazio Silone called Bitter Spring, A Life of Ignazio Silone. There's also some copies of a short and very poignant memoir by Silone, edited by Stan, called The Memoir from a Swiss Prison. There's a collection of graffiti from the Nazi prison in Rome, 1943, 1944, entitled Desperate Inscriptions. Stan was editor on that. He's a former research fellow at the Italian Academy for Advanced Studies at Columbia, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, at Oxford University, at Harvard, many other distinguished institutions. It might take me fully 30 minutes to go through the entire list of many well-deserved awards and honors that Stan has received, but I want to mention just a few further points. He's edited a number of volumes of conference proceedings, including The Legacy of Primo Levi, Answering Auschwitz, Primo Levi's Science and Humanism After the Fall. There's an edited collection, an essay by Carlo Levi called Freedom of Fear, which will be mentioned today, and we have copies there. Stan is a member of the National Book Critics Circle. His book reviews have appeared in the New York Times Book Review, Philadelphia Inquirer, American Historical Review, and other publications. He's working on some new writing on Naples. Edited conference proceedings and a collection about the city to be entitled Dancing on a Volcano in Naples to be published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Stan's books are fascinating, interesting, beautifully written, and bring us really much needed important insight into many of these resistance figures. And we look to them in times as we're in today for insight and inspiration. So, would you please now join me in giving a warm welcome to Professor Stan Pugliese?
So, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back here. I wish I could be here more often. It's really an extraordinary place. So, I'd like to thank both of my hosts and Canio himself. Every time I come in here, I feel more intelligent right away. I'm also intimidated when I see colleagues and people that I know all around. Anyway, perhaps this whole talk is going to be based on personal anecdotes, but let me begin. When I started doing this work professionally, when I was in graduate school, I was searching around for a dissertation topic, and a couple of my professors at the CUNY Graduate School suggested that I do some work on fascism. But I had to go back to them and say, you know, I really find those people detestable. And to think I have to spend like the next 5 or 10 or 20 years of my life thinking about them day and night, I really didn't want to do that. And so I did something that had not been done in America before, which was to examine a little-known anti-fascist movement called Giustizia Libertà, that was created in the immediate wake of fascism in 1922. And it was created by this charismatic character, Carlo Rosselli, who was from a distinguished Jewish family. You certainly have never heard the name Carlo Rosselli before. Maybe one or two people have heard it, but If you know Bernardo Bertolucci's film, The Conformist, do you know this film, which won the Academy Award like in 1971? And you know that The Conformist goes to Paris to assassinate his former professor, Professor Quadri. Professor Quadri is based on Carlo Rosselli. And Carlo and his brother Nello had created this movement, Giustizia e Libertà, arguing that unlike the communist movement or the socialists or the Catholics, that fascism represented something completely new on the political landscape of Italy and also of Europe. Nello was the historian, Carlo was the activist. They were the first to publish an underground anti-fascist newspaper. It implicated Mussolini in the assassination of a socialist deputy in 1924. Carlo was arrested and placed on confino, in prison, on the island of Lipari, off of Sicily, from which he escaped in a very daring, sort of like 19th century novel way, ended up in Marseille and eventually in Paris. The two brothers had fought in the Spanish Civil War on the side of the Republic, arguing that this was not a Spanish Civil War. It had to be reconceived as a European Civil War between, you know, liberal democracy on the one hand and fascism and Nazism on the other. For that, and for a radio broadcast that Carlo had done in May of 1937, in which he argued, oggi in Spagna, domani in Italia, today in Spain, tomorrow in Italy, which had all kinds of historical and even religious allusions, they were assassinated by the French Cagoulard in Normandy in June of 1937. And so that became the subject of my first book. But as much as I wanted to stay away from fascism in my academic career, it's sort of been like, you know, the white whale or the ghost or whatever, you know, literary metaphor you want to use. And of course, in the last few years, it has come back to haunt us with a kind of vengeance. I have gotten into trouble, especially with the Italian-American community over the last few years, in comparing some contemporary situations with fascism. And even in certain things that don't seem to have a kind of direct relevance to fascism, things like the Columbus Day controversy and the statue and all of that, that specter of fascism and Mussolini oftentimes arises. I can tell you in this context of Confederate monuments and Columbus, a story that happened about 10 years ago. I received a phone call from some good people in Chicago who probably saw my work and figured, oh, this guy is a real dyed-in-the-wool anti-fascist. And they wanted me to lend my name to a petition in which they were going to rename Balbo Drive in Chicago. I don't know if you know, but Italo Balbo was sort of like the Charles Lindbergh of fascist Italy, a famous aviator, and in 1933 he flew from Italy to Chicago, where he landed amongst great pomp and circumstance and a ticker tape parade, and brought like one of those stolen Egyptian obelisks, you know, which is now in Chicago, and a statue from Mussolini. Then he came to New York and he had a ticker tape parade and a speech in Madison Square Garden. And they had a petition. They wanted to change the name of Balbo Drive, and they wanted to rename it after Enrico Fermi, which, you know, nobody could, you know, really be against that. But I said, you know, let me think about this. And after a few days, I contacted them and said, you know, I'm not really sure it's a good idea to change the name of Balbo Drive. Would anybody want to try to take a guess of what my argument was 10 years ago? No? I mean, I personally, you know, admire Enrico Fermi very much, you know, the physicist. I don't know if you know this story, but in 1938, when he went to Stockholm to receive the Nobel Prize, he did not return to Rome because he had a Jewish wife. And the fascists had just passed anti-Semitic legislation. So Enrico Fermi and his wife went from Stockholm to New York, and from New York to Chicago and the Manhattan Project. But I said to the people in Chicago, I'm not sure it's a good idea to change the name of Balbo Drive, because then it would sort of erase a chapter of Italian-American history in which Italian-Americans were fanatically devoted to Mussolini and fascism. Another personal anecdote. I play in one of those Italian street bands out here. You probably have never seen them, but if you lived in Brooklyn or whatever, Queens, you know the tradition, right? The Italians have patron saints of their towns, and so on the feast day of Saint Anthony or Saint whoever, there's a mass, and they take the statue out of the church and they play a procession in the streets, and the whole nine yards. By the way, kind of another parenthetical footnote, that tradition of marching bands in the street gave black musicians in New Orleans the idea of playing jazz in the streets. There was a very intimate connection between Sicilian musicians, Italian musicians in New Orleans and the evolution of jazz. But that's a whole nother lecture. Ever since I started playing in this band in 1978 at the age of 13, there would be an elderly gentleman that would come up to us, and it was always a gentleman, it was never a woman, and asked to play Giovinezza, or Faccetta Nera, or Marcia su Roma. These were all fascist hymns and songs from the 1920s and 1930s. The band was formed in 1923, so we actually have those songs, and we would play them. And these guys would be very nostalgic and weepy. And when I was old enough and less self-conscious, I would go up to them and ask them. I said, but, you know, I was trying to figure out if they were, like, really fascist. And it turned out, it's not that they were fascist. It's not like they were dyed-in-the-wool fascist. Although, there was still this argument, well, Mussolini made the trains run on time. Oh, Mussolini, you know, made us great. And they were susceptible to that argument that we Italians are the 20th century descendants of the Roman Empire, and we deserve to have our Roman Empire, too, and all of that. And the argument was, well, Mussolini wasn't so bad. He did a lot of good things. And his only mistake was allying himself with Hitler. You know, it's like as though that was like a minor miscalculation. But I came to realize that fascism in the minds of Italian Americans in the 1920s and 30s functioned as what I called an ideology of compensation. For Italian Americans who came with the great wave of immigration at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, who were told, among other things, you are not white. I don't know if you know this, but on entering Ellis Island, Southern Italians were required to check off a box on the form that was not white. It was not black, but it was Southern Italian, which was considered a separate racial category. And of course, you know that the prejudice, you know, the WOPs, the Guinea, the mafia stereotypes, they're dirty, they're criminals, they're terrorists, etc., etc. It wasn't a coincidence that Italian anarchists really loomed large in the imagination and the fears and the nightmares of Americans in the 19-teens and the 1920s. And so, you know, if an immigrant group was being denigrated this way, you could understand how they would rally around someone who literally gets up at the podium and says, only I can save Italy from Bolshevism, and only I can save the Catholic Church, and all of this. And you know, the Vatican Agreement in 1929, the invasion of Ethiopia was extraordinarily popular. Many Italians and Italian Americans donated their gold wedding rings in 1935, and in return they received iron wedding rings. The high point of, let's say, appreciation or support for fascism came in 1936 when Italy declared that they now had an empire, you know, having defeated Ethiopia, the only independent African state remaining. With the Spanish Civil War, actually, things began to change. It was okay to go, you know, fight African barbarians, you know, and the song Faccetta Nera, Little Black Face, is a song that says, oh, little black girl, rejoice, because we're going to bring you a king, we're going to bring you civilization, we're going to bring you Roman law, etc., etc. That was okay. But to go fight in Spain against other Catholics, that was not so great. And then in 1936, with the alliance of Adolf Hitler, there was a further decline of enthusiasm in America for Italian fascism. And then, of course, with Pearl Harbor, Italian Americans did a complete 180. And you know this whole story. Maybe you don't know that Italian Americans were the largest ethnic group to fight in the Second World War. And it was not unusual for many Italian Americans soldiers to find themselves, ironically, paradoxically, coincidentally, in the towns of their grandparents. In fact, the book that I just gave Catherine and Marianne, there is a photograph of a soldier who is in Palermo who runs into his cousins, and they're having a gelato in the middle of the war. at the end of, it's a typical Italian experience of warfare. At the end of the war, you know the war is like an unmitigated disaster. Wherever the fascist Mussolini had, you know, boasted that, you know, our air force can darken the sun and we have 8 million bayonets and we are the descendants of Julius Caesar and all that BS. But in reality, the Second World War was a disaster, you know, in Greece, in Albania, in North Africa, especially on the Russian front. A historical footnote that you can mention at your next cocktail party, very important, which is that when Hitler was invading all of these countries without telling his supposed ally Mussolini, Mussolini decided to turn the tables and invade Greece without telling the Germans, and they were bogged down immediately, humiliatingly. And in humiliation, Mussolini has to ask Hitler for assistance without knowing that Hitler is planning Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union. Because Hitler has to bail out the Italians in Greece, Operation Barbarossa is postponed by 3 months. And that could have been really a turning point in the war because, as most military historians tell us, the turning point of the war was the Battle of Stalingrad and not so much D-Day. It's a whole nother story. After the war, as you well, you know that Italy switched sides in the middle of the war, right? At the end of the war, fascism was officially declared illegal. It was illegal for the fascist party to reconstitute itself. That did not prevent the Italians who were dyed in the wool fanatical fascists from creating a new political party called the Movimento Sociale Italiano with all kinds of insignia and icons that immediately, you know, showed that it was the heir or the descendant of the fascist movement. But it was really kind of fringe movement. What was not a fringe movement was that in the post-war period, there was a kind of subterranean fascism in Italy. Italy prided itself on going from a monarchy to a republic under the Christian Democratic movement and party, which, you know, had almost a kind of monopoly of political party, political power for the next 40 years or so. This was a kind of modus vivendi where the Christian Democrats would have political power and the Communist Party and the left would have cultural power, you know, publishing houses, journals, intellectuals, film directors, what have you. But that did not prevent a generation later a kind of really dark chapter in Italian history, which was that this idea on the part of some members of the military, some people in politics, some people in intellectual circles, to try for a resurgence of fascism. And how were they going to do that? They were going to do that by instigating a new kind of terrorism in the 1960s and the early part of the 70s. And it was called a strategy of tension. It was something like this. You're probably more familiar with left-wing Italian terrorism, things like the Red Brigades and Aldo Moro case. The Red Brigades and other people like Lotta Continua had decided that the Italian Communist Party was too moderate, too conservative, had decided to throw in its lot with parliamentary politics and had betrayed the workers' revolution. So in the 1960s and 1970s, there were all of these Maoists and really, really far left-wing organizations. And their method of terrorism was to pick out individuals like the CEO of Fiat or editors of right-wing newspapers and either kneecap them or assassinate them. The Aldo Moro assassination was something very different, sort of like an aberration. On the right, there was a different kind of terrorism, and that was indiscriminate terrorism in the form of bombings, the most infamous of which was the bombing of the Bologna train station, where something like, you know, 200 people were killed, and a bombing in the Milan Bank of 1969. The idea was to create these acts of terrorism and then blame them on the left, which would then create a kind of popular demand for someone to come along, pound his fist on the podium and say, I can take care of this situation. What we need is a military dictatorship. This was called the strategy of tension. And you probably know Dario Fo, you know, who won the Nobel Prize, his famous play, Accidental Death of an Anarchist, is based on one of these incidents where there is a bombing and the police are sitting in the police station and one turns to the other and said, that sounded like an anarchist bombing to me, you know, meaning that we have to go out and arrest some anarchists, one of whom, Tullio Pinelli, accidentally falls out of the window of a police station, thereby giving the play its name. And there was, you know, we now know that there was in the early 1970s an attempt at a coup d'etat by a prince from a noble Roman family who had been involved in the Second World War and responsible for one of these fascist organizations that had as its purpose the hunting down and the extermination of the anti-fascist resistance and allied soldiers. And it was in that context that Primo Levi, whom I'm sure you all know, you know, Survival in Auschwitz and others books, who had by that time become very well known. Primo Levi, I don't know if you know this, but Primo Levi's first book, which is translated in English as Survival in Auschwitz, but really the title is Se Questo è un Uomo, If This Is a Man, was actually rejected for publication by Natalia Ginzburg, Jewish woman, whose husband, Leone Ginzburg, had been killed by the Gestapo in Rome. Natalia Ginzburg was working as an editor at Einaudi Publishing House in Torino, the most famous publishing house in Italy, and she rejected the manuscript for publication, and instead the book was published by a very small publishing house. It was not until many years later that Primo Levi was, quote-unquote, rediscovered and became famous, and the whole nine yards. But in the late 60s and 70s, Levi was also very well known for being an op-ed writer. And the excerpt that I have here at the top of this page is from an op-ed that appeared in May of 1974 in the Corriere della Sera, which is sort of like the New York Times of Italy. And the title is interesting, A Past That We Thought Would Never Return. He writes, every age has its own fascism, and we see the warning signs wherever the concentration of power denies citizens the possibility and the means of expressing and acting on their own free will. There are many ways of reaching this point, and not just through the terror of police intimidation, but by denying and distorting information, by undermining systems of justice, by paralyzing the education system, and by spreading in a myriad subtle ways nostalgia for a world where order reigned and where the security of a privileged few depends on the forced labor and the forced silence of the many. I give this quote to my students because I want them to understand that you don't need black shirts and brown shirts in the streets with swastikas armbands to have fascism. And the problem is that many of them have grown up with Hollywood images of fascism, you know, if they have any image of fascism at all. Sometimes they don't even know where fascism is on the political spectrum, which is like a really horrifying thought. But it's the reality. There is another problem here, which is the problem of defining fascism. Even when it was in power, fascism was oftentimes accused of never having a formal political philosophy. It was not until the 1932 edition of the Encyclopedia Italiana that there was a formal essay about fascism, which was signed by Mussolini, but actually written by the philosopher Giovanni Gentile, in which it's argued that fascism aspires to be totalitarian. It was actually the first time in the late 20s that that term, totalitarianism, which was then later on made famous after the war by Hannah Arendt and others, it was the first time that that phrase had been used. And the idea that fascism aspired to a total penetration of society. And I try to tell my students the difference between fascism, and when I say fascism with a lowercase f, it encompasses fascism, National Socialism, is that unlike traditional regimes that were authoritarian, let's say the Tsar's regime in Russia or the absolutism of Louis XIV, in those traditional older regimes, the people who were in power, their attitude was, if you, the people, simply paid your taxes, kept your nose clean, and minded your own business, that was enough for us. But in the 20th century, with mass media, with all these other tools at their disposal, certain regimes like fascist Italy or Nazi Germany or Stalin's Russia are not content with people just staying home, paying their taxes and minding their own business. What is so diabolical about fascism is that it demands your active participation in the regime. And the total dissolution between any kind of definition or separation between the public sphere and the private sphere. And so this is what Mussolini was arguing. And as I try to tell this to my students by saying, fascism insists on intervening in your private life, even in the most intimate spheres, including the bedroom. So I like to give them these amusing things, like fascism decided, well, we don't have enough babies. You know, there was called this, you know, battle of the births, you know, this obsession with demography. They looked at Germany with, you know, 60 million people and France with 50 million people. And they looked at Italy with 40 million people and said, that's not good enough. So what do? They put a tax on bachelors, you know, they outlaw contraception. They make abortion, which had been rather, I don't want to say common, but had been well known and most people just didn't talk about it, outlawed. And as I, you know, tell my students, and they're all very amused by this, my paternal grandmother received a medal from Mussolini for having 11 children and service to the fatherland. My students think that's very cool, but I said for the family it was much more important the monthly check that came at the end of the month for those 11 children than the medal that my grandmother had. But I tried to show them that what's so pernicious about this is that the fascist regime or the fascist mentality insists that there is no separation between the private and the public sphere. What you think and what you do has to be at the service of the regime. Another problem is that because this kind of amorphousness of fascism, where you have something like one version in Italy and another version in Nazi Germany and still another version in Stalin's Russia, and I do include, let's say, the Soviet Union in this kind of what Ignazio Siloni called red fascism, okay, this kind of similar kind of totalitarian thinking, is that it's so diverse. So then the problem becomes still, you know, this idea of definition. Do you remember which justice was it? Was it Stuart Potter who in a famous case about pornography said, I can't define it, but I know when I see it. And I say this to my students too. I say, like, you know, if I showed you, let's say, a painting of a Renaissance nude and I showed you a centerfold from Playboy, you could probably tell the difference, right? Even though it's hard to define, let's say, obscenity. But the thing is, like, the problem is that to say, like, you know fascism when you see it the same way you know obscenity when you see it, is that kind of definition is not a good analytical tool. So the question then becomes, how can we define this thing called fascism? And for me, one of the best attempts made to define fascism occurred in April of 1925. Some of you probably know that April 25th is the day of national liberation in Italy. It's a holiday, it just passed. It's usually the day, it's the day that's considered the liberation, the end of the war, at least in Milan. It continued in certain other places. So April 25th. April 25th, 1995, which was the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Italy, Umberto Eco gave a speech at the Casa Italiana at Columbia University. And in that speech, which he called, sometimes it's called fuzzy fascism, sometimes it's called 14 ways of looking at a black shirt, sometimes it's called fascism, meaning like the essence, the first exemplification of fascism. And so let's take a look at some of these things that Eco had defined. By the way, for those of you that don't know, Umberto Eco was a famous semiologist at the University of Bologna. His specialty was medieval philosophy and literature. He became famous in 1980 for that novel, The Name of the Rose, you know. And then he became infamous for writing increasingly complicated novels that nobody could figure out, you know, including things like The Prague Cemetery.
Do you have one extra?
There is one extra, yeah. Actually, two extra. Hey.
You sure?
Yeah. So here are 14 points that Eco defined as being the essence of fascism. And when we read these, think about contemporary society. The first feature of Ur-Fascism is the cult of tradition. Traditionalism implies the rejection of modernism. Irrationalism also depends on the cult of action for action's sake. I don't know if any of you are familiar with this, but immediately preceding fascism in 1909, there was the publication of the Futurist Manifesto. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but Futurism was one of the first avant-garde movements of the 20th century. Filippo Tommaso Marinetti published the Futurist Manifesto on the front page of Le Figaro in February of 1909. Among other things, the Futurist Manifesto argued that they wanted to burn down the libraries, God forbid, and flood the museums. And they also argued that war is the world's greatest hygiene. What was fascinating about Futurism was that Marinetti got up and said, here we are in Italy in the 20th century, and all we hear about is Michelangelo, Leonardo, Raphael. Michelangelo, Leonardo, Raphael, Dante, Michelangelo. He said, basta with all those guys. You know, what we've been doing is the same kind of art for the past 500 years. And he had been to Paris and Berlin and other places, right? The futurists were the ones who argued for the beauty of technology, of speed, of dynamism. Marinetti argued, let's kill the moonlight, you know. We don't need any more poetry to my lady's beauty. What we need are poems about locomotives. Let's sing the erotic praises of the machine gun. No, really, of the locomotive, of the aeroplane, you know, of modern technology, you know. And that obsession with action, with dynamism, then seeped into fascism, especially the obsession with youth. Mussolini was, until Matteo Renzi, the youngest prime minister of Italian history, and there was this whole obsession with what was called the new fascist man, you know, and virility, which we'll talk about in a moment. So action for action's sake, the critical spirit makes distinctions, and to distinguish is a sign of modernism. So disagreement is treason. Five, besides, disagreement is a sign of diversity, and we cannot have diversity. Six, Ur-Fascism derives from individual or social frustration. Seven, to people who feel deprived of a clear social identity, Ur-Fascism says that their only privilege is the most common one, to be born in the same country. Eight, the followers must feel humiliated by the ostentatious wealth and force of their enemies. Nine, for Ur-Fascism, there is no struggle for life, but rather, life is lived for struggle. 10. Elitism is a typical aspect of any reactionary ideology insofar as it is fundamentally aristocratic, and aristocratic and militaristic elitism cruelly implies contempt for the weak. 11. In such a perspective, everybody is educated to become a hero. 12. Since both permanent war and heroism are difficult games to play, the Ur-Fascist transfers his will to power to sexual matters. Why go to Vietnam when you can stay in New York with bone spurs and sleep with as many women as possible? 13. Ur-Fascism is that, he says, avoiding sexual diseases was my personal Vietnam. That's a quote for the ages. 13. Ur-Fascism is based upon a selective populism, a qualitative populism, one might say. And 14. Ur-Fascism speaks newspeak. Now, when I read this essay at least twice a year since 1995, and the first time I wrote about it publicly was actually under the administration of George W. Bush, when the United States in 2003 was preparing to go to war in Iraq. At that time, I was criticized because I was arguing that I could smell the brimstone and castor oil of fascism in the air. And people was, you know, saying, no, no, be careful, you know, don't compare, you know, George Bush or the Bush administration to fascism. And there were people who were, you know, making direct comparisons with Adolf Hitler, which I don't think is a good idea. But here we are now 15 years later, and these 14 points seem almost a kind of diagnosis of our contemporary society. Just this morning, I was rereading, I don't know if you, oh, you have it here, because I asked Mary, Timothy Snyder's On Tyranny. I don't know if you know this short little pamphlet, which is really extraordinary. My students are supposed to be reading it this weekend for the last week of class. I'm teaching a course on intellectual and cultural history from the French Revolution to the 20th century. And in this little pamphlet, Schneider, who is a historian of the Holocaust, especially the Holocaust in Eastern Europe, says something really extraordinary. He talks about this whole idea of post-truth, right? That we have arrived at a situation in our society where political leaders, people on television, pundits, whatever you want to call them, even the President of the United States, can speak a lie, or whatever you want to call it, and there are no political repercussions. And so, what does that mean? We used to live in a society where not telling the truth came with some repercussions. Do you remember there was a campaign? I forget who it was, someplace in the South, where a senator was giving a campaign speech, and in the audience there was a gentleman of Indian descent or Pakistani descent or South Asian, and the person made a remark, called him a macaque, some derogatory name. And he was immediately, that Republican senator was immediately banished. I mean, it was like, that was it. The campaign was over, you know, his career was over. And I was like, that was only like 10 years ago. Today, you can get up in an arena in front of 20,000 people and actually, you know, instigate violence against other people. And it is actually praised. So you probably know that the first presidential debate took place at Hofstra University. And I was there along with my wife. We were not able to enter the hall because all tickets go to students, including the president's ticket. He gave his ticket to a student. And we were watching the debate with the rest of the faculty and people and students at various places on campus. And at one point, we laughed at something that Donald Trump said. But then I caught myself and I turned to my wife and I said, yes, we are laughing at it. But you have to understand that in much of America, people are eating this up. You also probably remember the night before the election in Montana, where the Republican senatorial candidate assaulted a journalist from NPR. There was no video, but it was on audio. And the commentary that night was, that's it, this guy is over. And by that point, I had seen the writing on the wall, and I said, this guy is going to be elected tomorrow, not in spite of the fact that he assaulted a journalist, but because he assaulted a journalist. And then looking back, I also realized that the whole thing with the Hollywood access tape actually created an incentive for people to vote for Donald Trump. A couple of other things I'm going to allude to just very briefly in passing, and then I want to sit down and we have a conversation. Another important book that I would highly recommend, last month we had a campus at Hofstra University, Mark Bray, who wrote a book on Antifa. Antifa is the anti-fascist movement that more or less was born in 1999 with the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, and is usually depicted in our culture and mass media as, you know, people all in black and, you know, like throwing trash cans through windows. But the Antifa movement, which is short for anti-fascism, rests on this historical conclusion that these movements, whatever you want to call them, whether they be populist or white nationalist or neo-fascist or neo-Nazi, have to be confronted. And they cannot be confronted simply on op-ed pages. They have to be confronted in the streets. In the early 1920s, there was a physical confrontation between the fascists and the anti-fascists. There was a group called the Arditi del Popolo, the Fighters for the People, that used to challenge the fascists in the streets of Italy. When the fascists would go to cooperatives, agrarian leagues, Case del Popolo, which would be like, how would you translate that? These would be places like had been established by either the Communist Party or the Socialist Party or even the Catholic Party for peasants to learn how to read or write or learn how to, you know, do agriculture. And the fascists would go there with the connivance of the local police and just like burn the whole place down, kill a few people. Their favorite method of entertaining was like to tie people up to like a lamppost and pour a quart of castor oil down their throat. And some people argued that, okay, once these people come to power, they're going to calm down, they'll be different, you know. It's the same argument in Germany, which was, okay, you know, once the National Socialists come to power, they'll be made respectable, that kind of thing. That never happened, right? But there were people at the very beginning who argued that these people, these black shirts and brown shirts, they have to be confronted physically in the streets of Berlin and in Rome and other places. And this is the tradition that was revived in 1999, okay? And Mark came to speak to our students, and we had this very interesting discussion, because now the debate is, well, what do you do when like a Milos Yiannopoulos comes to and says he wants to speak on campus, or Richard Spencer wants to come and speak at the University of Virginia, right? And there's this whole kind of debate about free speech and all of this, and you know, how, you know, universities have become this place that prohibits the ideal of free speech. But to me, the argument is very simple. I don't think we are under any obligation to grant the right of free speech to people as soon as they come to power, would deny the right of free speech to everyone else. And if they say that's not the case, you have to call them out on this. Just 2 days ago, I showed in class Alain René's film Night and Fog, which ends, which was made in 1955, which ends with courtroom scenes of commandants and concentration guards saying, I'm not responsible. I'm not responsible, right? I'm not responsible. And I say to the students, in this film, there is footage that was taken by Eisenhower in places like the Dachau concentration camps, and you've seen them, the skeletal remains, the bulldozers bulldozing bodies into mass graves. And I said to my students, remember these images the next time neo-Nazis parade in Charlottesville. Because what those people are saying by going in the streets is that they are claiming responsibility for that history. They may say no, but when you are in the streets wearing, you know, swastikas on the, and okay, yeah, they changed them a little bit, but they're not fooling anybody, okay? We know what you're saying. What you're saying is that you're claiming responsibility for what happened in those concentration camps. And that's why I see no problem in denying free speech to people who, if they came to power, the first thing that they would do is deny free speech to everyone else. Another book I highly recommend, Federico Finkelstein, who teaches at the New School, has a book out called From Fascism to Populism in History, which is really extraordinary because he draws very clearly the link between historical fascist movements like fascism in Italy and Nazism in Germany to contemporary populist movements. And the last book I wanted to mention, which Marian mentioned, is this book that was written in the spring of 1939 by Carlo Levi. Carlo Levi, from a distinguished middle-class Jewish family from Torino, medical doctor, arrested because he was a member of Giustizia Libertà, Carlo Rosselli's movement, sent to Confino in Basilicata in the deep south of Italy. There he wrote his most famous book, which is Christ Stopped at Eboli, which is also a great book by a film by Francesco Rosi. But before he wrote Christ Stopped at Eboli, in the spring of 1939, in exile in Paris, Carlo Levi wrote a book called Paura della Libertà, which was translated into English as Fear and Freedom. But that translation completely misunderstood what Levi was saying. Paura della libertà translates more correctly as fear of freedom. But I say to my students, how many of you think that freedom is a universal human aspiration? And of course, they all raise their hands, right? Because That's what we hear on every 4th of July and every political campaign and every State of the Union speech and every political speech that has ever been spoken, right? That all human beings aspire to universal freedom. Levy argued no. He said that freedom is a terrible burden. Terrible, not that it's bad, but in that it inspires terror. It's awesome in the sense that it inspires awe. Both terror and awe actually come from religious terminology. I don't know if you know this, right? Awesome, which has been so misused, but something that inspires awe. And Levy argued it's not the case that everyone aspires to freedom. In fact, as he saw in fascist Italy and Nazi Germany, there were too many people who were perfectly happy to say, ah, you, the Duce, the Führer, the general party secretary, you take care of things. Whereas we will worry about, you know, who's playing in the next soccer game, what are the winning numbers on the lottery, who's sleeping with who in the apartment complex, more important things. And Levy had this realization that there is no human universal aspiration for freedom. That's something that has to be taught. That's something that has to be cultivated. In fact, it's probably more common that we're happier to give up that burden of responsibility. And that's something that's almost impossible for my students to wrap their heads around, because they've been so, whatever little politics they know, whether the left or the right, has always been, oh yeah, everybody aspires to be free. And without this kind of deeper psychological understanding that in actuality, there is, as you know, Primo Levi called it and Carlo Levi called it, this eternal tendency towards fascism. Thank you.